This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNee. U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday refused to condemn the teenage shooting suspect accused of killing two people in Kenosha, Wisconsin, saying that he probably would have been killed if he hadn't fatally shot the demonstrators. Speaking during a White House briefing Sunday, Mr. Trump said the suspect was being very violently attacked before he opened fire. Last week, Kyle Rittenhouse grabbed an AR-15-style rifle and joined several other armed people in the streets of Kenosha, where businesses had been vandalized and buildings burned following a police shooting that left Jacob Blake, a black man, paralyzed. By the end of the night, prosecutors say Rittenhouse had killed two people and severely wounded a third. Mr. Trump also addressed accusations that supporters of his in Portland were themselves being violent. Video widely circulated online shows a caravan of Trump supporters shooting paintballs at protesters. Paint is a defensive mechanism. Paint is not bullets, he said. They protested peacefully. For the first time, a self-identified member of the militant movement known as Antifa has been implicated in a fatal shooting. The person is reportedly under investigation for killing a supporter of President Donald Trump Saturday in Portland, Oregon. The left-wing protest movement has resorted to violent measures in the past in opposition to right-wing extremist groups, but has stopped short of lethal tactics. The victim, Aaron J. Danielson, was shot in the chest during violent skirmishes between the members of a right-wing group called Patriot Prayer and counter-demonstrators that included Antifa and others. Police are investigating, but they have not named a specific suspect. The FBI said it is supporting that investigation. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. More than 849,000 people have now died globally from COVID-19, while in less than a 24-hour period, the number of infections jumped by about 200,000 to more than 25.4 million. Four countries, the U.S., Brazil, India, and Russia, account for nearly 15 million of those cases. The Federal Bureau of Prisons will begin allowing inmates to have visitors again in October, months after visits were suspended at the 122 federal prisons across the United States. The visitation plan is detailed in an internal memo issued Monday and obtained by the Associated Press. Wardens are instructed to immediately begin developing local procedures to reinstate social visiting. Fitness gyms, barbershops, and internet cafes have been allowed to reopen partly in the Philippine capital as the government further eased quarantine restrictions despite the country having the most coronavirus infections in Southeast Asia. President Rodrigo Duterte, however, placed the southern city under a mild lockdown after a rise in community infections, underscoring how COVID-19 cases have spread away from the capital, Metropolitan Manila, the epicenter of the pandemic in the country. Night curfew hours have been shortened in most cities in the capital and outlying provinces under the new arrangements, which will last for a month. Belarusian opposition leader will address the United Nations Security Council on Friday. Currently in Lithuania, citing fear for her safety following the election. And Baltic state Estonia, a non-permanent member of the Security Council, invited her to speak to the group. Meanwhile, Baltic states have imposed travel sanctions on Belarusian leaders, including the longtime president, Alexander Lukashenko. As protests against his leadership continue, the demonstration started after Lukashenko 80% of the vote in a disputed presidential election. Protests began when he was declared the winner of the presidential election early August amid widespread allegations of voter fraud. Sudan's transitional power-sharing government has reached a peace deal with an alliance of rebel groups from the troubled western region of Darfur. The government says it initialed a pact Monday in Juba, the capital of the neighboring South Sudan, with a coalition of rebel groups themselves, the Sudan Revolutionary Front. The final agreement offers the rebel groups political representation, integration into the national security forces, and economic and land rights. The pact also allows for people who fled Darfur to escape the bloodshed to return to their homes. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
is September the 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwandan authorities arrest Paul Rusesabagina, the man portrayed in the movie Hotel Rwanda.
Rusesabagina, he has been subject of international arrest warrant, so he has to answer charges of serious crime, including terrorism, arson, kidnap, and murder.
Uganda presidential candidate Bobby Wine defends his date of birth and academic credentials. Former President Laurent Gbagbo's party submits his name for the October election. And Mali's M5 protest movement continues its meetings with military leaders on transitional leadership.
We knew that with the military there's going to be some kind of chaos a little bit, but we are getting clear every day that the military understand that the movement was led by M5, and eventually we hope that the military will understand that the M5 needs to lead this process.
And Ghana's youngest learners tune in for radio reading program. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwandan authorities have arrested Paul Rusesabagina, the man portrayed in the Oscar-nominated movie Hotel Rwanda, for his role as a hotel manager in protecting Tutsis during Rwanda's civil war. Theo Sparks, acting spokesperson for the Rwanda Investigative Bureau, says Rusesabagina was arrested Monday through international cooperation. He was brought to the office of the Bureau for journalists to photograph him. Sparks says Rusesabagina will face charges including terrorism, financing terrorism, arson, kidnap, and murder.
Yes, Paul Rusesabagina was arrested and he is now in the custody of Rwanda Investigation Bureau.
Exactly. Where was he arrested? In Kigali or where?
Yeah, thank you so much. For the interest of justice and investigation, we won't disclose too much information about where he was arrested. But what I can tell you, he was arrested through the international corporations. And Rusesabagina, he has been subject of international arrest warrant. So he has to answer charges of serious crime, including terrorism, arson, kidnap, and murder perpetrated against unarmed innocent Rwandan civilian on Rwandan territory, including a place called the Nyabimata, Nyaruguru district in June 2018, and in the Nyungwe, in the district of Nyamagabe in December 2018.
Confirm for me, please, how true is it? One account here is that he was arrested in transit somewhere, probably in Addis Ababa. Is that true?
I don't know that. I don't know that one. What I can tell you is that he has been arrested through international cooperation.
As you know, he has said that he has denied this allegation of him sponsoring terrorist group. He has denied that.
Yeah, he's sponsoring, and first of all, he's a leader and a founder, and has been sponsoring extremist terror like MRCD and PDR Ihumure. So those groups were operating out of various places in the region and abroad. Where has he denied that?
He is 66 years old. What does your government hope to do with him? Are you going to put him on trial?
No, as I said, the investigation is still on the preliminary stage. So we cannot now confirm whether he has denied or he has pleaded guilty. The investigation is still going on, and his dossier is under investigation. And after his dossier will be sent to NPPA, National Public Prosecution, for the court. Of course, the justice has to do its work. The court has to do its work.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thea Sparks is the acting spokesperson of the Rwanda Investigation Bureau. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. In Uganda, the spokesperson for presidential candidate Rabo Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobby Wine, says President Yoweri Museveni and his supporters are doing all they can to discredit Wine because of the threat he poses to President Yoweri's re-election. Joel Senyonyi was reacting to a petition made to the Elections Commission by one Mali Mambirisi to take a look at Bobby Wine's academic credentials as a move to disqualify him. Mambirisi alleges alleges that there is no way that Bobby Wine, who says he's 38 years old, could have completed his Uganda Advanced Certification Education in 1998. Senyonyi says Bobby Wine skipped some grade levels because he was smart.
Anyone that stands up to challenge President Museveni's leadership gets to be met by all manner of things, including trumped-up charges and all of that. You remember Dr. Kizza Besigye, when he set out to challenge President Museveni, the trumped-up charges of rape against him, treason, and all these different things, you know, all of which charges, by the way, eventually failed because they were trumped-up. So it's not surprising that the state will use people like Mr. Male Mavirizi to try and look for all manner of ridiculous charges to throw at him. I mean, when he says and alleges that his academic qualifications are questionable, for heaven's sake. This gentleman was nominated as a member of parliament. He is a member of parliament. And anyone that qualifies to be a member of parliament qualifies to be president of Uganda. And our national examinations body called UNEB, Uganda National Examinations Board, has clarified that Honorable Kyagulanyi Ssentamu Bobi Wine properly went to school. He qualified, he passed, and all of that. The Electoral Commission also has his documents and so on. So the likes of Male Mavirizi really are people that just jump in to try and cause inconvenience and chaos, all of which will not succeed anyway.
Mr. Mavirizi has also questioned Honorable Bobby Wine's date of birth. I understand that the IT department of the parliament has come out to claim responsibility for what they call an error. What exactly did they have to say?
Just like he clarified earlier today, Honorable Bobi Wine Kyagulanyi Ssentamu was born in February of 1982. And as he told his story and the recordings of even his late father talking about this over 10 years ago, saying when he was in primary 6, he caused him to skip a class so that he gets to sit his primary 7, the primary leaving examinations, way earlier than he should have, partly because he was a bright kid, was a bright student, but also they had challenges of school fees, tuition, and so his father thought it wise, you know, since he was bright enough and could pass, let him skip a class so that the father doesn't have to struggle with tuition since he had many other children to take care of and so on. And so he skipped class and he passed highly. Of course, at the time, his father was advised that, you know what, for him to be able to fit among these students that are older than him, let's add 2 years to his age in terms of the documents, such that he gets to fit in and such that there gets to be no disturbance whatsoever. And so that's how his academic documents got to have that date of 1980, because his father was advised to do so that his child can be able to study, since he did not have school fees and tuition and so on. But years later, when Honorable Kyagulanyi was of age, he saw an affidavit clearly stating his exact date of birth, which was 12th of February 1982, and his other documents now have the correct date. So there should be no cause for alarm, you know. This happens a lot, really, in Africa, where children are caused to skip classes, partly because, yes, they have the potential, they're bright, but also partly because their parents cannot afford tuition, school fees, so they, you know, cause them to skip classes and be able to avoid paying tuition for an entire year.
Yoel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for Uganda presidential candidate Bobi Wine's National Unity Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. A member of Mali's M5 RFP protest movement says the group and the military junta are continuing their discussions on the way forward for Mali in terms of forming a transitional government. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has said that any transition period should not exceed 12 months. ECOWAS has also said that such transition should not be led by any active military person. Dr. Ramata Sissoko Cisse, president of the Change in Mali movement, says the group hopes that the military leadership will understand that it was the M5 RFP movement that began the revolution and therefore should probably lead the transition process.
Well, the military were warned to let the transition government be led by a civilian. And at this point, they're negotiating that. So the ECOWAS is placing sanctions against Mali and requiring the military to let the government, the transition government, to be civilian. So the M5 is discussing with the military to make sure we come to agreement so that we will avoid a sanction and put a peaceful transitional government that Malian can accept with their leadership, which is the M5 right now in Mali.
We reported yesterday that there seemed to have been some disagreement between the protest movement and the leaders of the military junta. Is there any disagreement?
Well, at this point, at the beginning, there were some misunderstandings, but things are being clarified by both sides right now, because the military understand that this is really a movement that was led by Malian, and they just wanted to avoid bloodbath, and they made the transition peaceful to ask the president to resign. But after the president resigned, many Malians didn't understand why the military did not, you know, just go directly to the M5. But many people also understand now that it's just a matter of time, because the military understand that the movement was led by the M5 and they had a plan that they had in place for the government to be put in place after the president resigned. So they had a plan, but the military, of course, you know, situations like this, it's kind of hectic a little bit sometimes. But at this point, I think there is a better understanding between the two parties. So they're listening. They talked yesterday already. They had discussion. And the M5 presented the document that explained how they want the transition to go by. And the military is examining the document right now to make sure they understand. And we have another meeting coming where they will discuss how they're going to put the transition in place and how they're going to consider the ECOWAS sanction against Mali, how they're going to alleviate the sanction or even completely stop the sanction so that Malian can go back into their normal business.
When I talk about disagreement, I guess maybe I should clarify more. The disagreement we thought was that the protest movement, wanted to lead any transitional government, and there was a friction between where the military would like to. But ECOWAS does not want anyone, current military leader, to lead any transition. So now, has that been ironed out?
Well, it's getting close to, not completely yet, because the military is still discussing with the M5. Of course, there are some disagreement because there was some misunderstanding between the ECOWAS and the military and the M5, and even the M5 and the ECOWAS. Everything is kind of mixed right now. And Malian are very, really worried right now about the whole unstable situation, not knowing what's happening tomorrow or anything. But we knew that with the military, there's going to be some kind of chaos a little bit. But we are getting clear every day that the military understand that the movement was led by M5, the strategic committee of the M5, that they are the one who started this movement, engaged Malian to stand up to fight for change. And I think the military understand that. So at this point, I can say that the things are getting better. And eventually, we hope that the military will understand that the M5 need to lead this process, and then just they need to be part of it, as all Malians should be.
Dr. Ramata Sissoko Cisse is the president of the Change in Mali movement. She was speaking with us from Lawrenceville, Georgia, USA. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September the 1st. In Ivory Coast, the party of former President Laurent Gbagbo beat yesterday's deadline for individuals seeking to contest the October 28th election to submit their names with the Independent Electoral Commission. The name of Guillaume Soro was also submitted. Both Mr. Gbagbo and Soro are in exile, and their bid to contest the election were rejected because the Electoral Commission said both Mr. Gbagbo and Soro are in exile, and their bids to contest the election were rejected because the Electoral Commission said anyone convicted of a crime loses his or her civil rights. Jean-Gervais Tchéide is the vice president for finance and budget of former President Laurent Gbagbo's party.
We submitted a candidate of FPI, our party, and also the group of parties who are supporting our candidate, President Gbagbo. And that was in the morning. The people, the members, and the population came very, very, it was a crowd in front of the headquarters of the Electoral Commission. So we gave all the documents that were requested, and they gave us a receipt to announce that we had submitted his candidature. So everything went very smoothly.
Was this a waste of time? Because, as you know, Mr. Gbagbo and Mr. Guillaume Soro are technically removed from the electoral rolls.
The first thing to know is that the removal from the list is not definitive. But most important is that we are in the spirit of somebody who is struggling for his rights to be recognized. So we have no right to give up. We must go on until we have a good result, which means that we have decided that Mr. Gbagbo should be our candidate. The majority of the population of Cote d'Ivoire, they are waiting for Mr. Gbagbo to be candidate, and they are even waiting for him to win the election. And since for about 2 or 3 weeks now, people have been demonstrating in the streets to make Mr. Ouattara understand that he must let Mr. Gbagbo be candidate, and not only be candidate, but come back to the country. So we have no right to give up because Mr. Ouattara and his regime are creating obstacles and are trying to, by political maneuvers, to prevent him from running for this term. So we keep on going. We will not give up.
Your party said that submitting the name of Mr. Gbagbo is in the interest of national reconciliation. But you know that the Electoral Commission said that Mr. Gbagbo and Soro were deleted from the roll because they lost their civil rights.
Yes. As I said before, Mr. Gbagbo is supposedly convicted of economic crime and et cetera. Now, this is a political trial. And politically, we have the right to continue, and we want political dialogue to create a situation in which nobody loses and nobody wins, but only the country wins. So we are in that position, and this position is for reconciliation. And Mr. Ouattara, as I said before, he himself has no right to run for the third term. This is clear. The Constitution is clear about that. And 10 years ago, he was candidate, and he had no right to be candidate. For reconciliation and for peace in the country, Mr. Gbagbo gave him the right to compete and to be candidate. We are expecting Mr. Ouattara to do the same thing for the peace in the country and for reconciliation's sake. This is what I can say.
Jean Chevetteide is the vice president for finance and budget of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. Since Ghana closed schools in mid-March to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus, the West African nation has had to quickly pivot to remote learning with online systems and educational TV shows for students from kindergarten to tertiary. For the youngest, the government has partnered with the U.S. Agency for International Development to launch a radio learning program targeting millions of primary school students. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Around the world, children are home and parents are tasked with juggling their educational needs, running the household and working. In a bustling community in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, Mother Dora Ope rounds up kids from the neighbourhood to join her for a daily radio reading program. The program began 2 months ago after schools closed. Ope says already her younger son's reading has improved. However, the program does require input from caregivers, and she finds many working parents in her area cannot be home to supervise their children. So she offers to help, monitoring the children while also doing her hairdressing work.
Well, you know, children, even when school vacates and they go to school, they ask them some things. They are not able to say it. Ah, look at this, long time from March. And we don't know the actual time they will ask them to come to school. So that's why I'm urging them to learn. So that by the time school will open, at least they will know something and read.
The hour-long programs are broadcast 6 days a week, teaching letters and sounds. They rely on learning through play. There are songs, games, and workbooks for the children to use. The U.S. Agency for International Development had been helping Ghana with reading programs. While this program is no replacement for face-to-face learning, James Dobson, director of USAID's education office in Ghana, says the intention is to keep people still interested in learning while schools are closed.
This really is a democratic approach. It gets out to the whole population, because the whole population actually, like 93%, goes to primary school. And this really presents a way of providing services to a large part of your population.
Ghana's Minister of Education, Dr. Matthew Opoku-Prempe, said from the beginning of the pandemic, the government knew it needed to focus on a range of remote learning initiatives to keep education going for the country's 9 million learners from kindergarten to tertiary. He said the radio program will still be used post-pandemic.
You have parents now using the programs to assist their children at home as well. So the data, the recordings, the resources we are putting, we're digitizing and putting out, it's going to be of tremendous importance to learning in this country.
While some students have gone back to school to complete exams, the government is now looking at a range of options to get everyone back safely. Minister Prempe says the pandemic has shown the need to use more technology in education. Jonathan Fletcher, Dean of the School of Education and Leadership at the University of Ghana, says technology and learning will require much needed training for teachers.
Hopefully, this situation will help people to learn in different ways, and that will be an additional skill, or people develop expertise in the use of different strategies in teaching.
Fletcher said despite interventions like the radio program, he did not expect young learners to have progressed at the same pace as compared to being in school, believing the students would be months behind by the time schools reopen. And not everyone has access to the devices needed for remote learning, including radios. Last week, the World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, urged governments in Africa to promote the safe reopening of schools while taking measures to limit the spread of the virus, stating school closures were harming them in other ways, including increased exposure to violence and exploitation. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
The UN Human Rights Office has condemned excessive use of force by security guards that killed 22 inmates and injured 8 others during a mass escape near a Madagascar jail nearly a week ago. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Security forces reportedly opened fire as hundreds of men were trying to escape from Madagascar's Farangana prison in the southeast of the country. The attempt largely failed. Out of 380 inmates, only 25 are still on the run. The UN Human Rights Office describes the squalid prison conditions as appalling and a hotbed for the spread of COVID-19. Agency spokesman Rupert Colville says it was the 7th attempted prison escape in the country since the coronavirus pandemic began. He says prisoners are living in fear of being stricken with this deadly disease.
As with many other jails, the conditions at Farafanjana are deeply troubling. The prison is overcrowded, conditions are generally unhygienic, food is poor, and the inmates lack proper access to health care. Our office has previously engaged with the authorities to express concerns about the conditions in the country's jails and the resultant dangers of overcrowding during the pandemic.
Colville says in the early stages of the pandemic, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet appealed to all countries to reduce overcrowded prison populations. He says she specifically urged the release of people at risk, including pregnant women, the disabled, the elderly, and minors. Colville tells VOA Malagasy authorities are aware of the problematic conditions in their prison system.
President of Madagascar has had embarked on trying to make changes to the prison system with the main objective of decongesting the prisons. But clearly more remains to be done. And the fact that there have been 7 such escapes, apparently the fact that it happened at the weekend is a factor because there's less security in the prisons on weekends.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the government to conduct a prompt, independent, and impartial investigation into the killings and injuries that occurred during the prison escape. It reminds authorities the use of force must comply with the principles of legality and necessity, and that it must be proportional and non-discriminatory. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Tuesday, September 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good day.